Have our remaining case of Price v. Commonwealth. And Mr. Curry, since your adversary has chosen to waive oral argument, we shall hear only from you.
Okay.
And I will tell you, I know from experience, arguing against a chair can be one of the most uncomfortable experiences that a lawyer can experience.
I look forward to it, Judge. May it please the Court, Liam Curry again on behalf of the Commonwealth. As the Court mentioned, I am at a bit of a disadvantage in terms of not having heard the arguments of opposing counsel just before I respond. However, I would suggest that the trial court, after the speedy trial, the motion to dismiss the indictment on speedy trial grounds was filed by the defendant, that there was a hearing on that motion, and the trial court absolutely correctly ruled that there was no violation of the statutory speedy trial rights.
Let me ask you about the basis of that ruling, and I understand the doctrine that we owe deference to trial court's interpretation of their own orders, but of course that has limits. Black can't mean white, up can't mean down. Here, when the court elected to use a fill-in-the-blank order that necessarily was going to involve counsel or somebody handwriting stuff on the order, and the court elected to enter an order after stuff had been written on it, and my understanding is there's no dispute that the August 3rd order that has the August 3rd to September 3rd, September 3rd to October 17th, October 17th to December 5th, that all that was written on the order, including the joint motion, see below, arrow, drawn down to it, pointed all out. That was all on it when the judge signed it.
I wouldn't concede that that is 100% clear that it was. I think that there were two hearings on August 3rd.
Well, right, but the judge, knowing after the second hearing, at the time of the second hearing, all of that stuff had been written on it.
That does appear to be.
And the judge had that order in front of her, and that order became part of the record. So if the judge disagreed with that, or all of that had been written in afterwards, the judge had an opportunity to get rid of it. Don't we have to credit that because it is part of the order that the judge knows about, signed, and put in the record? We can't just say you can ignore the handwriting, because if you ignore the handwriting, you ignore everything in the order.
Sure. I think the trial court addressed that issue by ruling in the alternative. And its alternative ruling was that if the argument was that the handwritten notations constituted the speedy trial rulings of the court, that those speedy trial rulings also failed to establish the relief that was sought by Price.
In these cases, of course, math matters, and nobody likes that. But if you have that order in front of you, I would like, and I would have done this with the appellant if the appellant had been here, walk through how I've counted things.
Okay.
And see if we can at least come to agreement on what we're dealing with before we determine what period is charged to whom. July 7th through August 3rd, the day scheduled for trial, is by my count 28 days. All of that time is charged to the Commonwealth, correct?
That's correct, Your
Honor. Okay. Now,
you said 28 days?
Yes. And I've got a calendar here if you want to check my math. Now, the order itself says 8/3 through 9/3 Commonwealth's motion or something to that effect. I mean, defense motion.
Correct.
Delta motion, indicating that everybody agrees that that period of time is chargeable. But, of course, you can't count, and we're going to run into this problem the way this order works, you can't count August 3 twice. It's one day. Having charged it to the Commonwealth, I can't charge it to the defendant. So starting on August 4th and going through September 3rd, that's 31 days. Everybody agrees, well, you agree that that time is clearly chargeable to the defendant.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. Now, it may be that in the abstract, all of the time, since that continuance is what moved the trial date, should have been charged to the defendant all the way to December the 5th. In the abstract, that might be true, but we have an unusual circumstance here.
Sure.
One, we have the Commonwealth going into the second hearing, and as best I can tell, agreeing that the next block of time, the September 4th to October 17th, was chargeable to the Commonwealth. And the order seems to reflect that. Do I have that right or wrong?
That is what the handwritten notation suggests.
Well, and from the transcript of the second hearing, the Commonwealth said they agreed to that, didn't they?
Yes, they did, Your Honor.
Is there any reason under the approbate reprobate rate doctrine that time shouldn't be charged to the Commonwealth?
I think I was hesitant to introduce approbate and reprobate into my responsive pleading.
I wouldn't have volunteered it either.
But I think what I would say here is the defendant introduced a theory of the computation of speedy trial that is not supported by statute or by any case law.
Well, right, but the beauty of approbate, reprobate is if you agree to it and it's wrong, you still can't argue that it's wrong.
That's correct. So
I'm confident you're familiar with that proposition.
You would be correct, Your Honor. The way that approbate and reprobate would work towards the Commonwealth's argument is that the second continuance order, this December order, also involves...
We're going to get there.
Okay. I don't want to take things out of turn.
But September 4th to October 17th is a period of 44 days. That period is in question, but that is the period that the Commonwealth agreed should be charged to it, and the order seems to say it is continued on the Commonwealth's motion. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Can't count October 17th twice, no matter that the order says October 17th. October 18th through December 5th is 49 days. Now, the trial court basically said, well, you can't count the time that the court's not available against the Commonwealth. In the abstract, that's not right, is it? If the person's in jail and the Commonwealth and the court says, I'm not available to try this case for 10 months.
The availability of the court or parties has no bearing on the speedy trial.
The clock runs.
Correct.
Now, the court, of course, was prepared to try the person on August the 3rd, and it is the continuance on August 3rd that necessitates the court looking for a new date. And so, under what you contend is the appropriate counting theory, all of that time should have counted against the defendant having set the ball in motion.
That's correct, John.
All right. December 2nd, we have the motion to continue for the death in the family. And an order is entered finding for good cause shown, the good cause being the death in the family, the case is continued. But you still wouldn't count from December 2nd because, of course, the trial date is being continued from December 5th.
That's correct.
So we start from December 6th. December 6th through January 11th, once again, when the Commonwealth first says it's available, is 37 days. It appears from the way that order is written that time is the court thought it was charging that time to the Commonwealth, and it was the remaining 48 days, January 12th through February 28th, which is the day the trial commenced because that was the day of the guilty plea, not March 1st, which when trial was scheduled. The court did not charge to the Commonwealth. Do I have those numbers and what the court appears to have done correct?
Yes, you do, Your Honor. What was the period of days again?
January 12th to February 28th is 48 days.
48 days.
That gives us a total of 237 days between indictment and guilty plea. So now we get to the subtraction part of this.
Yes.
And one of my big questions is, you did not cite the Wallace case.
Are you talking about apply to exceptions?
Yes.
Yes.
The sick child, is there a distinction to be drawn between sick child and death in the family?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. The Commonwealth thought its strongest position was to just argue that the kind of pure application of speedy trial law to this case charges that full four-month period to the defendant, and that's dispositive of the speedy trial issue. However,
if we have the approbate and reprobate problem, you don't get, you're a couple of days short unless something, if the 44-day period between September 4th and October 17th is counted against, correct?
If I don't know if I've done the exact calculations based on your numbers on where we are. So out of the 237, I want to look at subtracting all of the days that were attributable to the defendant to get a new number. It's 237.
The first bunch takes you, the first 31 days, August 4th to September 1, takes you to 206 days. Okay, and so then the question becomes, if you then take out the, if you, you can't subtract the, if you can't accept, subtract the 44 days between September 4th and October 17th, because the Commonwealth agreed to that, which I think is a fair reading of what happened.
Okay.
Then you would subtract the 49 days from October 18th to December 5, which gets you to the very lovely total of 157 days.
I'd be permitted to use my phone for to do some calculation.
Sure.
Thank you.
Unless anybody else has an objection.
I think it's only fair since nobody told us they'd be math in law school.
I keep thinking Chevy Chase's Gerald Ford.
Okay, 157. I see how Your Honor got to that number.
Okay. So that means in the period from December 6th to February 28th, there has to be five additional, assuming that the 44 days between September 4th and October 17th is counted against the Commonwealth, there has to be 5 days in the December 6th to February 28th period that's not counted against the Commonwealth.
Right, and I think the trial court, operating under this theory, the trial court found that speedy trial was told after January 11th.
The trial court did, but the question is that a correct ruling? Because that's one of the things they're challenging. And ironically, it seems now that we have flipped the position that we are from the first order, where the
right.
Commonwealth's position and what Judge Doyle found as his first ground for rejecting the motion to dismiss for failure of speedy trial was like, look, you defendants started this domino in motion. You're responsible for the entire period. Well, here, the Commonwealth started the domino in motion. So if those things are apples to apples, and Wallace is the reason they may, it potentially suggests a reason that they may not be, then the Commonwealth put that in motion, and the Commonwealth is responsible for that time, isn't it?
Two things. One, I would say that I would agree that the medical emergency in this place is of a similar nature to the statutory exceptions under the Wallace case that would excuse perhaps all of the time for the continuance from December until the guilty plea in, at the end of February. In the alternative, I don't know whether the appropriate label is invited error or approbate and reprobate, but I think what the defendant is effectively asking this court to do is, it is, and what it was asking the trial court to do was apply its incorrect theory of computation to the first continuance. And then it was asking, it's asking this court to look behind the continuation of the theory of tolling under the speedy trial provisions based on the availability of counsel of the court to recalculate those figures. And so I think that would be an approbation and reprobation.
Well, it seems to me that the appellant has always taken the position if it's the Commonwealth's fault or the court's fault, the clock continues to run, which is a normal position to take. The distinction between what happened in August and what happened now is the Commonwealth agreed to take some of the time. That was the Commonwealth's position. That wasn't appellant's position. And so that's why I think you get to this place, and then Wallace becomes the question. I have no idea what appellant's position regarding Wallace is, because nobody cited it on brief, and therefore, and they elected not to come.
Right. And I will just say, just to remind the court, that as you all are aware, that the panel is allowed to affirm on any basis that is supported by the record. And to the extent I haven't already, I would argue to the court that the medical, or the I guess it was a family emergency involving a funeral, a death in the family of the prosecutor, would be an implied exception under the Wallace decision. And there's certainly lots of language in Wallace about the importance of the prosecutor. You know, that it's not just a plug and play, you know, swap in, swap out situation. The importance of having a particular prosecutor on the case is important for not only the prosecution's interest in the case, but also the interest of justice for the community at large.
Thank you, Mr. Curry. We'll